Hello and welcome to Press X to Science, the podcast where Surgeon Simulator meets Louis Pasteur. Today we're delving into the world of virtual reality, what it is, where it's going, and how it is changing the way that we do medical science. But before we get to that, let me introduce our regular co-hosts. First up is science communicator and games-based learning advocate, Megan Pusey.
Hello.
And also joining us is industrial scientist and game developer, Phil English.
Hey, Tim.
If you want to learn more about our backgrounds, you can listen to our intro episode. But today we are looking at how virtual reality is changing the way that we're doing science. And this is such a big topic that we're probably going to be breaking it up into smaller chunks across several episodes just to make it a little bit of an easier listening go. Today we're going to focus a little bit more on the way that virtual reality is changing the way we do medicine and medical science. This is a really interesting and evolving field, but before we go into that, should probably just have a bit of a chat about virtual reality in the first place. What is it? So Megan and Phil, I know that both of you guys have had a bit of a try at the new world of VR. What are your thoughts?
It is certainly exciting. I have had a opportunity to play around with a Vive. I've kind of done both ends of the spectrum, which I think Megan has as well. I've had a go with a Vive, and I've also had a go with Google Cardboard,
which is the opposite end of the spectrum.
Cardboard space. Yeah, cardboard holder for your phone that you can then use your phone as a VR headset. They are really interesting, unique. It's a unique space, VR. It really does have a lot of different challenges, a lot of different hurdles that they're still trying to overcome, most notably the whole nausea thing.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big one. But I think it's got a lot of potential, especially in these kind of areas, I think, that we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, I've had a try at Samsung Gear, Google Cardboard, and also Oculus and the Vive. I haven't tried the PlayStation one yet, or the HoloLens, or the new Android Daydream. I was blown away by the high-end stuff, and I can definitely see how transformational it is already and is going to be.
Now, Megan, you have a bit of a unique view on VR because you're also the, I'm going to go ahead and say, the Australian trailing champion for virtual reality sports.
You mean runner-up? So I was in a Meganaut at PAX Oz 2016, and the final round was Cowbots versus Aliens, and unfortunately, best out of three, didn't quite get there, but it was so much fun.
Awfully close, though, and it was an incredibly electric game to watch, even as a bystander.
It's just so different to just sitting on the couch and using a controller or sitting at a PC and tapping away, because your whole body is involved.
Yeah.
So you have to think differently as to how you play the game, because now what your body doing matters.
And especially, I mean, you guys were on a quite a large stage with a pretty, you know, well decked out area with the two different Vive units going head to head. But
yeah, so you got about a 3x3 meter space in which you can move physically, and that where the sensor can still see you, I guess.
Yeah, so I mean, that was, like I said, it was incredible to watch. It must have been even more incredible to be in there competing. I've also had a lot to do with VR. I've had the incredible luck of being able to use almost every system on the market with the exception of HoloLens at the moment, thanks mostly through work, because we have to test out some different VR units for use in things like science communication exhibits that we're building. So we are already starting to see just how different virtual reality is to most of the traditional gaming that we've all spent a lot of time in. And virtual reality is definitely starting to pose, like you said, some really interesting issues. Nausea being a big one. I fortunately have never felt nausea in VR, and I test that to my year sailing tall ships. I don't get seasick anymore, so that's fine. But I've seen the effects of seasickness and the devastation it wreaks on someone's body. So I can imagine how, if you do suffer nausea in VR, it's going to be something of a less than comfortable experience.
Well, I know some people even get nausea playing first-person games.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a spectrum, right?
Yeah.
But it's because it's so much more immersive, I guess, if you do get seasick or nausea sickness from... Nausea sickness? Sure, let's go with that. from playing video games, VR is probably going to exacerbate it quite a bit. But today we're looking at how it does the exact opposite, how virtual reality can heal rather than be a hindrance. And we've got a couple of really interesting examples that have popped up. Some of them have... These are experiments that have been out going back to... I think 1997 was the earliest one we found.
Yeah,
it's been around for a while.
So, obviously, virtual reality as a technology is not brand new. It seems to be almost cyclical in nature. It sort of comes up and dies off when everyone realizes it's kind of awful. But it almost feels like we're there. It feels like we've just reached that point where it's got enough sticking power to stay around for a little while longer. So,
and I think now some of it's becoming more affordable, slowly becoming more affordable at the consumer level.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about those early ones, those were the big time zone stations that you had to sit in and strap down, and there was a giant headset that had to be on a winch so it didn't break your neck if they let it go. Those things were horrific.
Yeah.
So one of the first and I think what would probably be considered some of the easiest uses for virtual reality in medical uses has been the use of virtual reality to overcome things like, for example, phobias, something that we call exposure therapy. Typically, exposure therapy in non-virtual reality circumstances means taking something that someone is very, very afraid of. They have a phobia. And a phobia as well, important to realize that this is an irrational fear. Like, you don't have a phobia of drowning, because it's very rational to be afraid of drowning. It's a horrible way to die. So phobias tend to be more on the side of things that are, you know, most people, the average sensible person, would go, well, you don't really need to be afraid of that.
Yeah, it's like a you're afraid of water in a glass rather than drowning.
Exactly.
Like, A little bit of water, totally fine. A lot of water, that's...
Or you're afraid of spiders, but just any spider. I mean, very, very large lethal spiders. Maybe you don't want to go near them. That's not irrational. But seeing just any spider from any distance and your body goes into a cold sweat and you just, you know, evacuate your bowels all over the floor, that's a phobia. That's on the other end of the spectrum. Yeah. So
I think that's something a little bit more than that as well. That's maybe a curry from last night.
Maybe it's IBS. So exposure therapy means taking small amounts of the thing that a person has a phobia for and just gradually introducing them to. There's another side to exposure therapy, which is, I think it's called saturation therapy. Have you come across that one before?
No.
It's essentially where they take someone who has a phobia and then just throw them in the deep end. So they just say...
I think that's a bit different.
Hair, you're afraid of spiders? Hair is all the spiders. And you're now in a room with them and they're all over your body. They, you know, psychology is not an exact science. There's a lot of...
It might work for some people. I can't imagine that working for me.
No, I can't either. But so
I don't think that's the first choice or first thing they would try.
No, I think that's once the slow exposure therapy doesn't work. But again, none of us psychologists, so I guess we're mostly talking from a place of a relative ignorance on this one. But in these papers that we've been reading, exposure therapy with virtual reality has shown some really promising results. A lot of it is, for example, in the spider example, having a really cartoonified, obviously not real spider in the virtual reality environment at a very, very long distance to sort of slowly get the person getting used to that shape, getting used to the way the spider moves, getting them used to the sort of mechanics that surround the spider, and then slowly over time, gradually making it more realistic, amping up the intensity a little bit until eventually the person could just pick up a spider.
Yeah.
So,
I guess the main advantage in virtual reality in this case is the fact that you just have all of the control. Like, even if you were to do exposure therapy with, you know, real spiders that weren't, you know, that were harmless, you still have that, like, uncontrolled movement that they can do, even if there was, like, glass between you or whatever. But I think probably for people knowing that they're in a virtual environment and that there's complete control,
yeah,
they can stop it at any point, they can control. They quite often are given the controls as well, to actually be able to control how far away they are from it, and you know how big it is, and all that kind of stuff. So they actually have full control over how much they're being exposed to this thing.
And I think also they can easily repeat the experience again and again through therapy. And also, I think the same exposure therapy that they use for phobias, they've also been using to treat PTSD.
Yes.
For returning war veterans, which was really interesting.
Yeah, because, I mean, PTSD, essentially, when you boil it down, is the same mechanism in the brain, right? It's taking something that is not necessarily a genuine threat to you right now, but your brain perceives it as being just as real a threat as it was at the time.
Yes. And this is one of the ones that we noticed had been researched for quite some time. So I think the original paper was released in something like the original study was using a 1997 version of a Vietnam VR scenario.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is something that's been used for quite some time. It's only just becoming more, I guess, now that the tech has now reached the point where the realism can be really kind of quite involving, I guess, quite a lot amped up. I imagine, I mean, that it says in the paper that they used the VR application as inspiration for an Xbox game. So you imagine back to the time when Xbox was new and amazing, you know, the graphics weren't that great back then. Like, they would have been pretty janky. But nowadays you do have, like, the ability to really simulate things very, very closely to the original kind of thing. So I don't know whether or not that would be good or bad now that I'm thinking about it.
Well, I guess, but, like Tim said, you could, you could use a scale, you know, start off with really blocky, obviously fake, and then, like, slowly ramp it up to more realistic as you exposure therapy is progressing as well.
From the bits that I've been reading as well, it looks like a lot of PTSD therapy prior to VR mostly revolved around still images and sound. And they found that sound and recreating the audio experience of combat and what was triggering the PTSD was enough by itself. And they didn't even need the visuals. So it might be that being in a virtual environment that doesn't even look anything like real, so long as the sound is somewhat authentic, it can start to bring on those, you know, issues and symptoms that PTSD sufferers have to live with.
But you could even do sort of like a mixed methods approach to treatment, like start off with just images or audio alone and then build up to virtual reality as a sort of final step before, like, real life stuff. You know, same with the phobias as well, like, as your tolerance improves.
Yeah, that's right. And because everything is in a game world, you have all the metrics for that as well. So you actually know exactly when things were happening, so you've got even more,
data ability to analyze.
To actually analyze and interpret. Yeah, for sure.
And the other thing is, like you're saying, I mean, even with the spiders side of thing as well, it's that sense of control, the ability to be able to press one button and stop the simulation, and not even necessarily, you know, stop it to cancel it, but to literally pause it. So time stops. All the things stops. You still have the vision around you. You can still see the spider, or you can see the war scene, or the whatever it is that is triggering the phobia or the issue. And by stopping time, you're actually exerting a kind of power and control over the situation that you cannot get in real life. You know, the ability to stop a spider in its tracks and then see that you are in control of it, rather than it being in control of you. That's a really powerful tool that no other therapeutic method can really offer.
Yeah, for sure.
So these are all looking at ways we can use VR to change how the mind is working. Another one that sort of touches on this one as well was a couple of papers that are looking at how we can use virtual reality during operations. This could be instead of or as an ancillary to traditional anesthetic. So there's two different types of anesthetic. There is a local anesthetic or a global anesthetic. And local is about just numbing the area that you're working on. And then the total anesthetic is, you know, taking your entire brain down and putting you in a state of deep, deep sleep. Using VR during a local anesthetic has shown to not only improve the efficacy of the anesthetic, so you need less anesthetic, but also in some cases has even suggested that you don't need the anesthetic at all. And that's a really interesting concept as well, because anesthesia is a really, really difficult area of medical science. It's not an exact science. It's very, very difficult to get different combinations. Most anesthetics are combinations of different drugs in different amounts. So it's like a weird chemical cocktail, and every person's palate is different. You know, that everyone wants a slightly different take on the cocktail. So anesthesia is a really, really difficult thing. A lot of, I don't know the exact statistic on this, but I know that a lot of complications that happen during surgeries, more often than not, are a result of issues with anesthesia rather than, you know, the surgeon messing up or some other, you know, thing going wrong.
Especially in older patients as well.
And younger patients.
Generally speaking, Yeah, that's right. At the usual risk demographics is the fact that, putting someone under a general anesthetic when they're not necessarily, it does put them at risk of essentially not waking up ever again. Anything that can reduce the number of general anesthetics.
And they do try and avoid its use where possible. You know, if possible, they'll try and use local or something else instead.
Yeah, I mean, anesthetics is not—it's not good for you. You don't want to be doing it too often at all. And what's more if you are a redhead or you have red hair dominant genes, you take up to 1/3 more anesthesia for the same effect. This is a well-known effect amongst anesthetologists. That's part of how difficult this situation is. I mean, if someone could just intrinsically need more anesthetic and you don't know that, it just adds so many more extra variables to the thing. So using VR in a situation like this would mean that you could really, really ramp down the risk in surgeries. And ramping down risk is incredibly important because it also means you can speed up the surgery. It means that you can need fewer people around for it, which sounds like, you know, it's going to take people out of a job. But more importantly, it lets those people do other things. There's no shortage for need when it comes to medical professions.
And again, this is one of those ones that actually has been around and been researched for quite a while. We actually found two papers, one that was in 2005, which references another review that was done 10 years before that. And the one 10 years before that was lamenting the fact that the technology wasn't quite there, whereas the one in 2005 is saying, oh, we're starting to get things like LCD displays and video cards and stuff like this. And so, obviously, now that nice bridging of the tech and the application is there, and obviously cost comes into it because hospitals are, you know, they are businesses most of the time. Even if they are run by governments, there's still an expectation of managing costs. That all kind of comes into it, and it seems like VR will actually be something that will be seriously considered in the future. So it's really interesting to see, like, as we've been reading through these papers and stuff, to see that the technology has come up to what they expected.
I've been reading a paper and they sort of came up with the idea in 96, but like you said, it's, or 93 to 96, but they sort of haven't until the last few years been able to do a whole lot with it. I mean, they've been doing their best with what they have, but they're looking at pain management for burns victims using virtual worlds and VR as a distraction for the brain. And like you said, I guess reducing the use of other medicines that aren't always 100% safe, like anesthesia. So they're saying, but I guess their hypothesis was, because VR is so immersive and it draws you into this other world, we can really distract and draw your attention away from the pain signals. And I think that's also the basis for the hypnosis for pain management as well.
Yeah.
And so they're sort of going down that track with their research, which was really interesting because I hadn't really thought about it as being a distraction and using that immersive distraction as a good thing.
Yeah. I also find it really interesting reading that they actually have done a little bit of study. Like, it doesn't seem like they've done as much on this as maybe would be useful, but they've done a little bit of study on what kind of virtual reality is actually useful. Like, so it's, they mentioned that that it needs to be the distraction is most effective when it soothes the patient in addition to providing engagement. And so there could be like a lot of research done on, you know, what is the best kind of game to give someone. Like you can't be playing Call of Duty when you're, you know, when your leg's being cut open or something like that. Like that's probably too much. But it would be really interesting to see different people come up with different ideas of what would be the optimum game to give someone to distract them.
Well, the pain management one I was looking at, I can't find too much information, but we'll put up the links to what I have found. They were playing a game called Snow World. So it's all about like throwing snowballs and being in cold places and things like that. Now, I don't know if the evidence shows whether that game was, the game was the reason why the technique was effective, or even how effective this is on a large scale, because they had very small sample sizes. But like you said, it'll be really interesting as this becomes more prevalent to see what type of games are the best for different situations.
Yeah, I mean, so this opens up a really interesting area between the difference between pain versus nociception. So the idea is that pain is the, in very large scare quotes, emotional response to nociception, which is the physical response to a negative stimulus. And the idea is that, you know, if you look at, for example, some surgeries, they're done on areas of the body where there are very few, if not no, nerve endings. So you can't actually feel pain there. But because you know that it should hurt, your brain sort of fills in the gaps and gives you the pain stimulus. It gives you the signals as if you're experiencing the pain. So it's all about, you know, swapping those wires around and sort of changing the way the body responds to these kinds of things. But what,
so I know, brain surgery, you can't feel, apart from the opening up to access the brain, you can't actually feel anything. There's no nerve endings or touch receptors in your brain itself.
Exactly.
So someone, you could, like, sometimes you're awake to make sure they haven't done anything wrong.
Almost all the time, in fact, in brain surgery.
Yeah,
because they need to make sure that they don't affect the language center, for example.
Yeah, yeah. And so they're always talking to you, checking how you're going and all that sort of stuff. And I thought,
that's when you
so
see those
exciting,
crazy, like, videos of people playing violins while they're, like, brain is open.
And they've got someone's hand in there.
Yeah, it's pretty, they're pretty gruesome. But
so far we've looked at the ways VR handles the way the brain works, but not really VR changing anything physically with the body. But it looks like that might not entirely be the case. And this is something that we covered in our PAX presentation as well, which you are more than welcome to go and check out if you're interested in this kind of stuff. But what we looked at was a couple of examples where virtual reality was being used to not necessarily cure, but treat quadriplegia and paraplegia. Now, this is
Weren't they intending to improve their, what do you call it?
Quality of life.
Yeah, that's one.
Yeah, so it wasn't, there was actually no intention to treat the symptoms. It was just a quality of life experiment. It was trying to give them a way to feel like they were still able to move, to make them sort of be happier about their circumstances. Which is not to downplay that. That is hugely, hugely important. Mental health is very, very important and is a legitimate part of the healing process in this respect. But what they found was when they put the virtual reality gear on the patient who had no feeling below their waist and then gave them a tactile feedback vest, which is essentially a vibrating vest that simulates impacts from bullets or, you know, movement from walking. After a while of getting them to play through this soccer game, they started to realize that the patients were starting to regain feeling in their extremities of their feet. And that's insane, because these are patients who were told that they would never, ever have feeling ever again. It was just, it was a known quantity. It was gone forever. And just by playing this virtual reality soccer game, they were starting to reverse some of the damage. This blew the doctors and the researchers away. They, in the paper, which we'll link, they openly say they had no idea what was causing it. And they had no expectation that it should happen. And yet, something was going on. And so the next step was to try and figure out why and how this was all working.
Yeah, yeah. This was one of the ones that really just yeah, definitely blew me away. Like, I guess it's been known, it's kind of been known for a while that the when you have these spinal injuries, quite often all of the gear is still there, right? All the, like, it does heal eventually.
I think, it depends on the type of injury you have, because it does depend vastly on the type of injury, vary, but yeah.
Yeah, like in you know, a number of situations, you have all the structure there to do exactly the thing that you were doing before, like walk around and do all that stuff. But there was just no way for you to train your brain to recognize that again, because I think, just,
yeah, it's not sending a signal down there.
Exactly.
Because
it's like, oh, that's gone.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it needs to anymore. It's like that, you know, that tube station's been closed down. I'm not going to bother sending trains there.
Yeah.
So this went into the mentality of the either you lose it or lose it sort of way of thinking about brains. And the idea was that once they lost that area of their body in terms of being able to control it or feel from it, the brain said, well, rather than lose this area of my brain that normally controls my legs, I'm just going to reroute other signals through this area to make it faster. So it's still using the bits of grey matter that we normally use for locomotion, but it was using it for them for different areas. By then tricking the brain into thinking it had use of its legs again, by saying, well, you're getting, you know, you're walking, I guess we're using legs again, the brain just started rerouting.
Yeah. Oh my god, it's infectious.
Rerouting itself. So the idea is that it's starting to reopen up those areas of the brain and say, well, I guess this is for walking again. We're doing it again.
Yeah.
And good. So some of these patients actually have since managed to take steps, assisted, but steps of their own that they triggered with their own mind. I mean, this blows me away. It brings me right to the edge, because this is such a serious issue for people. It's, like I said, it's been one of those areas of medicine where we've just sort of written it off. We've said, you can't do this anymore outside of radical stem cell surgeries and some other crazy things that have never really worked either. So the idea that a video game technology has started to, you know, be such an important tool in this field is, it blows my mind. It really blows my mind.
I think it's one of those great science moments where the researchers and doctors are kind of like, that's funny.
Yeah. They're some of the best ones, right? Yeah. Is when they're like, oh, that was unexpected.
And then like 20 years from now, when in some cases we can suddenly, through therapy and treatment, heal some cases of paraplegia and quadriplegia, will be like in the history books, they'll be like, yes, this was this moment in 2015-16 where the doctors found this and they didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
No, yeah. It's just one of those great serendipitous textbook moments.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it looks like virtual reality has come a long way since 1993, that's for sure. And it looks like there's a really bright future for it as well. And this is just it in the field of medicine. We've got some examples of some pretty crazy things in other fields as well. So we're really excited to discuss these topics with you guys as well. But we are going to save it for another episode because we are rapidly running out of time. So anything else you guys want to add before we finish up?
We'll also post links to stuff on people using VR to do surgery training, which we didn't get around to talking about because we just had so much stuff to talk about and we ran out of time. But doctors are actually training to do specific surgeries in VR because to do it on a real person is dangerous.
Right. And also not just training, but making the way they do things like keyhole surgeries way, way faster because of some of the technologies used as well.
So now they're using 3D cameras instead of 2D cameras. So now the doctors can see in 3D while doing the keyhole surgery so that they do it quicker. You're under anesthetic for a lot less longer, so it's a lot safer as well. Like up to like a 30% improvement or I can't remember the exact number, but huge.
Yeah. I mean, I'll take any number on that one.
Yeah.
Phil?
No, I mean, I just think, we've talked about only three things. There are a lot of other awesome things happening in the world of VR. So, yeah, really excited to talk about that some more.
Yeah, and actually play some more games in it.
Yeah, maybe one day. when I can afford a Vive, maybe.
Next PAX.
Yeah, that's it.
Excellent. So thanks so much for listening. You can find us on the web at pressx2.science and on Facebook as facebook.com/pressx2science. We would really appreciate it if you could share the podcast through social media or word of mouth, because it means a lot to us. It helps us get out to more people. And rate us up on iTunes with 5 stars if you enjoyed it. If you didn't enjoy it, rate it with something else and tell us why. Also, feel free to send us in any questions, comments, or feedback to questions@pressx2.science. From the three of us, we'll talk to you soon.